You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and the other person on the screen who does not look like me is our guest today, and that is, and I hope I say this correctly, and Shong Saavedra. Shong Saavedra. And Shong has a company called Save My Sense, C-E-N-T-S, and the occasion for this conversation is a recently published book. How recent, by the way?
January 2025.
I thought it was really recent. So, and it is called Wealth is a Mindset. Change your mind, change your money. And so I know everybody's all of a sudden now paying really close attention because, right, that's what everybody wants to do. Wait a second, really? I can just change my mind? So, but before we dive into that, first of all, thank you. Thank you for being willing to spend the time. Sorry for the technical delay at my end. And can you give us a little mini bio of how you became a person who is speaking about saving and putting together wealth of your own and managing your money, et cetera, et cetera. How did you get there?
I was born into a frugal immigrant family. My parents were frugal by necessity, and I'm an only child. So most of my life was spent watching what my parents did. And so naturally, and also I guess with a mindset that's dedicated towards curiosity, in my college years, I learned how to have a budget so that I don't overspend the money that I have available on my food and school supplies. And that continued into my early career such that throughout my 20s, I not only continued to go for high-paying and increasingly high-paying jobs, I also saved and lowered my expenses and invested the difference so that by the age of 31, I had finished saving for my retirement. Now, at that time, I was still in corporate and doing the career that I had. It wasn't until 2023, after having my second child, that I decided to leave corporate forever to pursue Save My Sense and to teach the rest of the world about the connection between mental health and financial wealth.
Between mental health and financial wealth. And so when you say wealth is a mindset, right, or that it's shaped by a mindset, or it is, how do you say that? It's manageable by a mindset.
Yeah.
You're not talking about, this is a question, you're not talking about, affirmations and attracting money. And you're talking about something else. So what is that something else? What makes you so sure that it is entirely about a mindset?
Well, I can use my own personal experience as a starting point, but also I can point to evidence both in scientific research as well as the clients that I've eventually come to take on as part of my work and Save My Sense, that even the most intelligent, highest earning humans on earth can still struggle with personal finance and managing their money when their mental health is not in a healthy state. So for example, even during the time that I was raising my income and lowering my expenses, I kept spending more than what I had budgeted for, and it was a reasonable budget. And I was like, I must be just bad at budgeting. Maybe my math is off. I just need to go back and look at my Excel sheet a little bit more. And then I came to realize that, no, it was actually the mindset that I had at the time. I had a really bad attitude towards life. I was very much in a scarcity mode most of the time, as highly competitive, but not in a very attractive way. And so it took really changing where my mind was coming from to then eventually lead to a better state where I could hit my financial goals. And I also see that in the people that I'm helping today.
Could you dig a little deeper in that the idea that somehow you were in a scarcity mindset? You were in a what do you mean by that?
Absolutely.
It's not enough. It's just not enough.
Yeah. So instead of seeing, for example, me saving money by cooking at home instead of getting takeout or going out to a restaurant, all I could think of was, well, my food doesn't taste all that great because I was a beginner cook at the time and I burned a lot of my food. and I was also really like pitying myself saying, look, you know, I got a good education and I have a high paying job. Why am I still cooking at home and not going to the nice places that all of my other friends were doing so? And so I couldn't see the positivity and the potential of what I was doing. Instead, I was just complaining a lot.
What was the work that you were doing? You say you were in corporate. What was the kind of work you were doing?
I was a management consultant, so did a lot of strategy consulting to Fortune 500 companies. And then depending on what years we're talking about, I also actually directly was in the strategic departments of some Fortune 500 companies.
I see. So, and I love the story of you and your husband sort of deciding to live on the lower of your two salaries in New York City. I thought that was kind of ingenious. I wonder, it was obviously possible. One could do it, but it doesn't sound like it was easy.
Well, the genius was my husband. This was not my idea at all. That was not what I had imagined the start of our marriage to look like. But his reasoning at the time was we both knew that we wanted to eventually become parents. And we both also knew that it's also a heavy financial decision and there would be maternity and paternity leaves involved. So he's like, why don't we do away with a lot of that anxiety? But just right now, before we have children, learn to live on less so that we have room to grow when a child comes into the picture. And also it gives either of us the flexibility and also the relief to not have to rely on two incomes from the start, because we recognize, especially as private sector employees, that you're at will. Your job could be gone any day.
Right. So. Right. And did you immediately see the genius of that or no? You had to get...
I saw the reason in it, but I didn't necessarily love trying to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Was it? I mean, I suspect people listening to this was it hard? I mean, it sounds like a lot of sacrifice.
It was really, really hard in the beginning, but it actually got easier over time. Once you kind of get into the habit of things, you figure out what your limits are and what they were not. Because I had to acquire a lot of new skills, learning to really cook for myself, learning how to stay healthy and work out without going to a fancy gym, navigating the New York subway and bus system because there's no budget for cabs or obviously no car ownership at that time, amongst other things. Oh, and you know, managing a smaller professional wardrobe, like I can't be buying clothes all the time. And then also learning how to do our research to travel on a budget, which we've gotten very creative about over the years.
That's amazing. And you say you started this project, not necessarily, I'm assuming the project came before the idea for the book.
Yes.
You started this living project. And it was between when you started and when you were 31.
Yeah.
That you felt, quote, done. There's enough. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, and then when you reached whatever counts as enough, did you stop?
No, because that was just for us. The original goal wasn't, okay, let's finish saving for retirement. That wasn't even in my language at the time. Like I knew, okay, it's important to save and important to invest for one's future. I had done those calculations in my 20s, and both my husband and I coming into our marriage already had significant investments. Like both of us brought in more than $100,000 of investments when we got married. That being said, the acceleration, the push towards being much more frugal than before was to back out this breathing room for eventually having children with the expectation that once we had children, we would continue working to support the children's lives. And it was during this process that my friend introduced me to the concept called financial independence, retire early, FIRE. And I read the popular blogs about it and did the calculation and realized that by age 31, I reached the calculation, which is your net worth is 25 times your annual expenses. But that was expenses were just, you know, the two of us. It didn't include children. Sure. So realistically, sure, we still needed to continue working to support any eventual children. Now, it took us some time to have kids, but now we are expecting our third by fall of 2025. Thank you. So it's very exciting, but also I think it just gives us more optionality to have more choices in and freedom in how we spend our time. And that's why at age, let me make sure I got my age right, at age 38, when I eventually left corporate, you know, that's much later than age 31, that was when I was like, look, okay, reach the goal of saving for retirement, would love to have more time with my children, more flexibility. And I think, you know, 25-year-old me couldn't have imagined exactly what that looked like, but I just knew mathematically it was possible.
And so you've been actively doing that for yourself for some time, and then you started this company, Save My Sense.
Yes.
Right. And how long have you been doing that?
Since 2017.
17.
Yeah.
And so that's a chunk of time. Yeah. Would you say, because I think one of the things that goes through people's minds is, well, it's easy to say that. It's easy to talk about that if you're talking about somebody with whatever the pedigrees are that allowed you to get respectable corporate employment. And it sounds like your husband likewise. But is this doable by everyone, or is it, you know, you have to have a certain level of facility managing your way through the world?
I think it is doable as long as you keep your expenses controlled relative to your amount of income. So obviously my husband and I both had high incomes. We also lived in high cost places like New York City, San Francisco. Now we're in Southern California. Our expenses are just high to begin with, but I have coached people my clients range from ages 20 to 70. There are people who live in very low cost states. Vast parts of the US are much lower cost than the big cities, where they don't have to have $100,000 income level to be able to save for a nice retirement. And many times it's because they kept their costs very low. Maybe they didn't have, you know, a lot of children, or they sent their children to public school, so they didn't have to pay a lot for private schooling. And also in many cases, especially those who work for the government, they may also have a pension that is part of their compensation, but it's more invisible. But over time, that pension grows alongside their own investments, securing their retirement. So yeah, I think it's doable, but you just have to recognize where the opportunities are and customize that to your personal situation.
Well, so perhaps just to tantalize people, is there low hanging fruit? You know, I mean, you meet somebody at a party and they say, well, you know, that might be possible for you, but not everybody's in that situation. But are there things that, you know, have patterns emerged as to where people are making unfortunate decisions about how they live their life?
I can usually tell what your money habits and behaviors might look like by hearing just a couple minutes of you describing what you grew up around money like as a child. It's very highly predictable, and the book talks about some of the three main root causes, like the three kind of categories of behaviors that a lot of people fall into as adults with negative money habits. And the good news about all of this is that it can be reversed, but it has to be reversed in a, I guess, a scientific approach. And to bring this really more to light, I meet a lot of people who say that they're impulsive or show that they're impulsive in their spending, that they feel like spending is uncontrollable, that there's no way they can rein in their money. They don't know where their spending went to. It appears likely chaotic. And a lot of that has to do with either you growing up in the household where your parents did not teach you adequately or showed you what planned personal finances look like. And it may also be related to perhaps current situations that are putting your brain into either depression or anxiety. It's been
say more about that. Talk about that.
So really fascinating research spanning decades of time, but I'll just pick out maybe two pieces of evidence that I like the most. One, Harvard and Princeton economists ran an experiment where they approached basically people who lived in areas with a lot of payday loans. Like, these loans have incredibly high interest rates, but the people who often go for payday loans, they just need that money even before they get in.
Absolutely.
They found that, and they then compared and contrasted these people against those who did not live in areas with a lot of payday lenders. They found that regardless of income, these individuals understood the value of a dollar. Like, they understood that a payday loan can be really expensive, but the people who went for payday loans just felt like they had no choice. Their brains were fried. When you're living paycheck to paycheck, and you're under stress, just trying to get food on the table, shelter over your family's head, you don't have the extra bandwidth to even think ahead. Like, your brain just is overflowing. And these scientists called this phenomenon bandwidth poverty. Then on the psychological side, there's also evidence that when you're overwhelmed, your brain actually can't even function. Like, at the best level, like, if you think about the skills required to be good at finances, you need math, you need rational, less emotional thinking.
But you need math. You need, but you're not talking about advanced math. No. You're talking about adding and subtracting.
Arithmetic math.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And planning ahead. Being able to weigh pros and cons, you know, make a decision when you don't have the most amount of information. All of these skills are called executive functioning skills, and they're controlled primarily by the prefrontal cortex in our brain, the sort of what's considered the last layer of the brain that gets developed and the most complex part of our brain. When somebody is even mildly stressed or anxious, we're not even talking about, you know, severe depression or anxiety, just even mild anxiety, your brain actually pulls blood away from the prefrontal cortex and moves that blood into the amygdala, which is more of our reptilian fight or flight, you know, basic parts of our brain to kind of preserve itself.
Right.
And so you can imagine when someone has no bandwidth, they're just in survival mode. They can't even elevate their brain, get the blood back into the prefrontal cortex to make
executive
these
function goes out the window.
Yeah, you can't. Right. You're not even equipped to make those decisions you need to be better. So one of the quick fixes that, I mean, I wouldn't say it's quick, but it's the first thing that I look at in my book is ask yourself, how is your mental health? Like, how are you feeling? Are you in one of these states? And if so, what's driving that? How can we get you out of this really anxious, unhappy state?
Well, okay, so not to be the devil's advocate, because the devil doesn't need an advocate, obviously, but somebody's response to that is, well, I don't have enough money to make ends meet. You're telling me to calm down. I'm stressed because what's the problem? Well, the problem is I don't have enough money.
Yep.
So
and that's
what
we change. The belief, the first thing is you have to believe that there is something better out there. Because that's scarcity is when you think you're stuck. You think that, oh, I came from poverty, I'm going to stay in poverty. my parents normalized credit card debt. I'm going to be stuck with credit card debt, you know, for the rest of my life. I literally actually would ask somebody in that state to say, you don't have money right now, but you will in the future. Like just even believing that more is possible. And yes, this kind of goes into the affirmation zone a little bit, but we got to start. We got to start with just rewiring that belief, because if you don't believe it, then yeah, it's not going to happen. That's the mindset part.
Yeah. I mean, the stories we tell ourselves, they don't necessarily come true, but if we're telling ourselves negatives all the time, you know, we're sort of on the lookout for ways to make those negatives a reality.
It literally changes your brain chemistry. Like neuroscientists have shown that the more positive feedback your brain receives, it actually also alters the brain to function at a healthier state.
So back to the low-hanging fruit. There's sort of getting your arms around what your mental state is.
Yep.
What else is there?
Looking at what you're feeding your brain with. We spend so much of our lives on digital devices these days, phones, computers, screens. What's going into your brain from those screens? Is it negative, you know, stress-inducing, anxiety-inducing content that, you know, puts you on alert, puts your body into survival mode all the time? Or can it also be positive, supportive, community-building type content? You know, I fully acknowledge that also the media that we consume and also the people we choose to surround ourselves with can have a huge impact, especially when you look at people who possibly come from communities where there is, you know, a very high level of poverty, where you don't see examples of wealth. Well, you can't learn from someone who hasn't gotten to where you want to go, right? Like let's say I set a new goal, like I want to be able to run a marathon. I'm going to learn from people who've run marathons. Like right now, I don't live near people who run marathons, but I'm going to find somebody who does. And so also think about elevating your sources of information and maybe removing the negative people in your life. Like it's very often that your own family members and even your closest friends can also be the sources of sabotage on your change journey. Because
how so? You mean by telling you that's impossible, you're living a pipe dream?
Because if you came from poverty, and let's say your parents were in some ways, you know, responsible for a lot of that, then they also don't necessarily know how to see ahead and see what's the future. And they might doubt the things that you're trying to do because it's maybe different than what they've done, and maybe it makes them feel bad about themselves. The way for them to lash out is to judge negatively.
And do you run into all these things when you're in your work?
Absolutely.
With individual clients?
Yeah. Especially the judgment from parents, the judgment from friends, or even just the perception of judgment. Like it doesn't have to be direct, but maybe people just, you know, feel it in some way. And I'm like, yeah, it's influential. Like that, there's a phrase they say, you are the average of like your five closest friends or the five people that you talk the most to. And I don't like to, you know, put numbers to that, but I would say when I found myself in the company of people who are really focused on their career, yeah, I just learned a lot about growing my career. If I'm in the company of five people who really, really love investing, yes, I'm going to hear a lot more mentions about investing. It's, you know, whatever area of growth you want to lean into, you need to put yourself closer to people for whom this is their passion.
I'm wondering where risk taking fits into this conversation. Do you encourage people to take risks? Do you encourage them to increase their capacity for taking risks?
Yeah.
Because why?
I actually define scarcity mindset as the avoidance of risk. Not believing that risk can pay off.
Right.
A lot of people who are scarce, they believe that situations are fixed, that there's, you know, the pie is fixed. You can't grow the pie. You can't rising tide lifts all boats, that kind of stuff. Without risk, then there's no reward. I firmly believe in that. But also at the same time, healthier brains are better at judging risk versus reward. Like right. if you're not healthy, especially in very, very unhealthy brains, you see people gamble a lot because they cannot perceive correctly that gambling right. always leads to losses.
Right.
So in
right.
the beginning, when you're just starting to take risks, go take the biggest risk of your life. I don't know what that means. I don't know.
I'm thinking of members of my family, some of whom was like, wait, you did what? Like what? And you think that's going to pay off? I don't understand.
Take little ones because yes. you can reverse the mistakes of little risks a lot more easily than, you know, a risk of a big one. And also each individual eventually has to arrive at a tolerance, a risk tolerance that they can accept. And that's different for everybody. I often ask people, what's your poker playing style? Like when you're at the poker table, do you go all in all the time?
All in all the time.
Then you really love risk. Or do you fold very quickly? Then you're a risk avoider. Sort of when you think about financial risks, it kind of has to match your poker playing style in some way. But regardless, if you want growth in your life, you need to take measured amounts of risk over time. And once you see them pay off, once you have more money, more wealth, yes, it also gets easier to take bigger risks. Like I would argue, one of the biggest gambles I've made with my life, for which I don't know what the payoff is just quite yet, is leaving my corporate career. The more years that I am out of a corporate career, the more difficult it is for me to return to it. I make less money now. I always make save my sense. Being you know, abundant, I do believe that that's not going to be like this forever, but we'll see. The skill set that made me good in corporate, it's very different than the skill set that made me good at Save My Sense. Completely different skill set. So I would say it would be very difficult for me to return. And also just structurally, it would be difficult for me to return to the exact kind of job that I had previously. Just right. structurally doesn't work for me.
I see what you mean.
But that being said, it's a big risk. It's not something that I would have done in my early 30s, but it's something that now with a lot more wealth, I can take as I'm nearing 40 years old. So,
right.
yeah.
Right. You got your age. You just gave yourself two more years. So relax. So, are there other sorts of particular mistakes that people often make? Right. I mean, one has to do with, I mean, I guess it's a mistake. Maybe it's that they didn't even think about it, but mindset, having a mindset that that does not lend itself to accumulating more wealth is problematic. But you know, that's not a mistake that people have chosen to make. But are there sort of recurring mistakes that in a way? Like you spoke about when you first started, you spoke about, you know, deciding that maybe it's time to learn to cook rather than eat out all the time, right?
Yeah.
Are there those kinds of things that seem to be a pattern?
I would not call it a mistake because it's much more about how do people frame their choices? Like you're constantly making the trade-off of fulfilling a desire today versus fulfilling a desire in the future. But it's a trade-off, right? If you spend money today, that's money that you don't have for the future. Right. In personal right. finance terms, that's it. And everybody has a limit. There's some people for whom some of the very extreme frugal things that I did, like, you know, not buying new electronics for a year or not buying new clothes for a whole year, are just trade-offs. They're not willing to make. That's fine. But I do challenge most people and I say, if you want to make a meaningful change in your life, focus on the areas that actually make meaningful changes, like the somewhat kind of annoying advice of like, oh, make coffee at home or whatever, skip the avocado toast that was given to us millennials. And it's not so much talking about skip the coffee, which over the grand scheme of things doesn't save you as much money as changing your rent, for example. But it's just saying you have to start with a small habit where you're willing to give up some comfort or convenience. And then once you adopt one of those in a small area of your life, then you're much more willing to do it in a larger area of your life. But don't wait for that large change to happen. Like, some people need to make big changes right away. I'm coaching people where they're like one impulsive transaction away from going to credit card debt. Like, that's how precarious the situation is. So I'm like, can we get ahead of it now? Like, avoid, you know, 29.99% APRs, which are wild. And could you reduce your haircuts? Could you, you know, clean your house a little bit less with the house cleaner or something like that? And can you also learn to be okay with it and not like care so much about what other people think about what you're doing right now? And I think that's really what it comes down to, is like not judging yourself so harshly for wanting to do something different.
Do you do a lot of, for lack of a better, I know you're not a psychologist, but do you do a lot of psychology work? I mean, it would, you know, getting people to pay attention to how they are making the choices that they're making and being okay with them seems like it's taking you into a whole different territory.
It's 80% psychology, 20% math, as I like to call my work. But when I do perceive, you know, people who really do need help from psychotherapists and psychiatrists, I do refer them. I'm like, really? Hey, you know, don't be afraid to get that help.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Because I see it as a medical issue. It's not like there's something wrong with you. Like, oh, you were born this way and you're for some reason, you know, broken or whatever. I kind of see it as, I wish we could normalize having a mental health episode just as common as people say, oh, I got a cold the other day. I'm going to go get it treated, either with medicine or with visiting a doctor, but I'm going to get it treated instead of letting this, you know, make my life miserable for a long, long time.
Well, and it's also, you know, it's a weird setup, right? The way people learn to treat their colds, they don't necessarily go to the doctor. They go to the pharmacy, they go to the grocery store, and they get the whatever. So the equivalent of rather than getting, quote, professional help, the equivalent is they spend money. They buy themselves this or that, you know, they do that impulsive buying that gives them, right? Exactly. It's giving them the, or it's they're walking into it thinking that this is going to make them feel better. But in fact, it rarely does.
I describe that as the spending cycle in my book. I call it the trigger action reward cycle, where when you feel bad or when you're in a bad state of mind and you just want to feel better right away, that's the trigger. The trigger is this awful, you know, feeling in your head. And the immediate action that you usually take is you spend on something short term. Your action is you spend on something and your reward is, hey, you feel better temporarily. Like, I totally get it. Sometimes I go out and I get an Asian drink called a boba because it just makes me feel better in that moment.
Sure.
But most of the time, this trigger action reward sequence doesn't solve the underlying issue, which could be a job that's probably too toxic or stressful for you, or perhaps a strife in your relationship that you need to talk to your romantic partner about to really address it. And when people keep falling into that same spending cycle over and over and over without realizing that they actually have to change their reaction, like the action, instead of buying something to feel better, the action is, oh, this is a bad situation. Let me dig to the root of my situation and improve it so that my reward is longer term, that my reward is going to be feeling better over the long term. That's where the big change happens, is if you can dig into that longer term reward and pursue that, your life will improve over time.
Well, and it's also, we're living in a world where it's easier and easier. It's not just go out and get the boba. It's go to Amazon and,
oh yeah,
and,
one click.
You know, make the click and you instantly feel better. You haven't gotten the thing yet, but you instantly feel better just because it's coming and you've got that, you know, that little jolt of oxytocin.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a hard world for people who are impulsive like that. That's a more and more challenging world to navigate.
It's literally changing the chemistry of your brain to decide, okay, you know, the reptilian survival part of my brain, be quiet. Let me think. Let me try to think more than just one step ahead and try to see, you know, 1, 2, 3 days into the future, a month into the future, and decide on something better, which is why if your mental health improves, you can do more of that. But a very easy thing that I tell most people is 24-hour freeze. It's in my book.
Yes, exactly.
24-hour freeze. Whenever you find yourself wanting to buy something, and hopefully I do it, I catch it before you click that one click button, put it in the shopping cart, then close the window, wait 24 hours. Because your body's just all acting up. It's hyped up on those emotions, hormones, whatever. I definitely am feeling it as a hormonal pregnant person right now. It's like, oh, your emotions are just high strung, and it needs time.
The 24-hour freeze
needs time for those to kind of calm down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know you have a hard stop, and I'm sensitive to that. So I want to ask you now, what are something that feels important to say that we haven't said yet?
Yeah. I really got to say,
buy that book.
Don't beat yourself up. Don't live in constant regret of your past actions. Because people, you know, hear about all this and they're like, oh, I wasted my life. You know,
I blew it. Yeah.
I messed up. It's too late for me. I've made so many mistakes. I can't walk back, you know, what I've done in the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And I'm like, look, you know, that's kind of the devil talking in your brain. Like, you're being really, really hard on yourself. There's so many stories, including those in my book, where people had to overcome tremendously difficult circumstances, drug addicted parents, accidents that changed their physical health forever, divorces that were not amicable and maybe even violent at times. Like, you likely had to overcome very difficult things in your life. And as part of that, you made decisions that weren't the best at the time, but it's what you knew. And you got to forgive yourself for doing that. Because if you keep wallowing in regret over what happened in the past, well, the thing is, I say regret is one of the least productive emotions that we have out there. Hope is one of the most productive emotions. Regret is one of the least productive emotions. Mm. And I want to move you away from regret into hope, into love, because whatever you choose to do going forward, eventually I would hope that most of it is coming from a place of love for yourself, because you are so worthy of loving yourself into a better future.
Mm. That's a beautiful message. Thank you for even saying that.
Yeah.
So I know I will put things up on the screen, but you have space to take on more clients, because some people will see this and say, hey, I wish I could reach out and get some help. Well, so one way of doing that is for them to purchase the book, are you actively taking on new people? And you said you work with people who are in their 20s and as old as in their 70s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a wide range, because I have a wide range of offerings. Obviously, my book is one of the lower cost options, and it's also do it on your own time. I have mini courses. I have longer courses. I have group coaching, and I have what I call one-on-one coaching, private coaching. That's the one where some of the stories are featured in my book, because I literally work with you or you and your family one-on-one to help you get to your goals. And I think it's just such a honor to be asked and say, hey, Xiang, like, I'd like your opinion and your help on this. So a lot of people sometimes they just reach out with an email and say, I'm kind of going through this. What do you think? And usually I send people some resources, some freebie downloads. And I'm like, hey, you know, get started with this. Let's try it out and see what you like. And then we'll go on from there.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, Shong Saavedra, thank you so much for being willing to spend the time. Sorry for our delayed start. Cool. And but thank you.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the great conversation.
Pleasure for me.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.